All right. This is our fourth session dealing with Yosef and his brothers. In the previous sessions, we've explored chapter 37 of Sefer Bereshit in depth. The first session, we dealt with the beginning of the chapter, from favorite son to hated brother. The second session, we dealt with Yosef the dreamer, Yosef's two dreams, and what reaction that engendered from the brothers. And last week, we spent our time studying Mechirat Yosef, dealing with the question of who really sold Yosef into slavery, some different views, hopefully also some different views than the traditional day school perspective. And then we spent last week, the second half of the class, on an interesting motif dealing with what the brothers did with the money from Mechirat Yosef and how that had reverberations much later on in Jewish history in the period of Bayit Sheni. Today's class is going to take us through much, much more text than we've spent time on in the previous sessions. We've up till now studied one chapter, 37, in depth. Today's class is going to go back to some points from 37 and highlight several other points in the next seven or eight chapters of Sefer Bereshit. And then if we have time, and I'll tell you what we'll be focusing on in our text study, will be focusing on the particular roles of the brothers, Yehuda and Reuven in particular, and what goes on in the dynamic between the brothers that eventually leads Yosef to reconciliation. Sorry, my headset is not working well today. Sorry. So we'll be first dealing, the bulk of today's class will be dealing with Yosef and his brothers reaching reconciliation and what needs to take place in the dynamic between the brothers and in the roles of individuals so that Yosef can step forward, reveal himself, and reconcile with his brothers. If we have time, towards the end of the class, and those are some of the sources that I gave you the details of, we'll be looking at a side question, which is why did Yosef not reveal himself sooner? Yosef has been away from his family. One could argue that the beginning of his separation from his family when he was in jail in Egypt and in Potiphar's house working in a slave-like conditions, then he might not have been able to make contact with his family. Although, as we know, even from modern times, people in jail are allowed to send letters. But certainly as Yosef rose to power in Egypt and became an independent individual with great autonomy, one could have argued that Yosef ought to have tried to make contact with his family sooner. And why didn't he do that? And then connected to that is, once the brothers do come down to Egypt, how come Yosef waits so long to reveal himself? And how come along the way he puts them through various trials and tribulations? The money being returned in their sacks, asking for Binyamin, taking of Shimon, the Gavia. He puts them through the ringer before ultimately he comes out and introduces himself in chapter 42 and says, Ani Yosef. So we'll try and deal with that question towards the end, and if not, you'll have some interesting things to study for Parshat HaShavua. When we first scheduled the class, my goal was that the final class, this class at least, be the one and only class that matches Parshat HaShavua. So this week, Bezrat Hashem on Shabbat, we'll be reading Parshat Vayeshev, the story of Yosef and his brothers, and what we're studying today finally connects back to the parasha directly. So what we need to do now is study, call it a big unit of text. We're going to be looking from chapter 37 through chapter 44 of Sefer Bereshit, and we'll be focusing on the roles of particular brothers in the dynamic with Yosef. When we studied the chapter that we've been studying up till now, chapter 37, we saw that at the beginning of the story, if you open up to the early verses of Perek Lamed Zayin, chapter 37, it set the background for the growing tensions between Yosef and his brothers on the one hand, and the favoritism and the outward love of Yaakov towards Yosef. And in the previous classes, particularly in the first class for these verses, we focused on Yosef being the favorite son, but the brothers in Pasuk Dalid, they hated him, and they couldn't even speak peacefully to Yosef. And as chapter 37 progressed, and Yosef became the dreamer and the teller of his dreams, we're told that in Pasuk Hey, Yosef dreamt, and he tells it to his brothers, they add hatred to him. Their hatred increases even before they hear the content of his dreams. The person they already hate, the brother they already hate, is dreaming, and that alone makes them add hatred before they hear the content. And then when he tells them the content, in Pasuk Chet, they respond to him, and they ask him, are you really planning to rule over us and to dominate us? That as a result of this, they added additional hatred to Yosef for his dreams and because of what he just told them. So three times we're told that Yosef is, hello to Peter, welcome aboard. We're studying some highlights from chapter 37 with the goal of continuing through the next seven chapters of Sefer Bereshit to explore the dynamic between Yosef and selected of the brothers who are mentioned by name, and to see what changed in the relationship between Yosef and these brothers that ultimately allowed Yosef to reveal himself in chapter 42. And I mentioned that if we have time at the end, we'll deal with an additional question, which is the question that most of the sources you have grapple with, which is, why didn't Yosef reveal himself sooner? He could have sent a letter, he could have sent a messenger. How come he didn't give his identity over beforehand? So we are now doing a quick recap of chapter 37 and the dynamic between all the brothers. Up till this point, we're up to verse 8 of chapter 37. Up to this point, the brothers are one collective group. No particular brother is named as having more hatred or less hatred or having said anything directly to Yosef. But we have, by the end of Pasuk Chet, three different expressions of hating Yosef and of not being able to speak to him b'shalom. By the second dream being repeated, by the end of the repetition of the second dream, Pasuk Yud Aleph tells us, Vayikan uvo echav, that the brothers added something new. It's not additional hatred, but this time it's kin'ah. This time it's jealousy. So the emotions have grown, and as we saw last week, this all set the stage for Mechirat Yosef. This set the stage that when Yosef came to meet the brothers who were shepherding their father's sheep, when he found them in Dothan, they don't even get to see him or to speak to him directly. And as soon as they see him coming, this is Pasuk Yud Chet, verse 18, as they see him approaching, still from a distance, we're told, Vayitznaklu oto lahamito, they're already busy plotting how to kill Yosef. So three times hatred, one time not being able to speak peacefully. Then we're told they add jealousy into the picture, and by the time they next encounter him, they're plotting his death. They're trying to kill him. And now we'll zoom in a little bit on some of the psukim that we looked at last week, but now we're not looking at the question of who exactly sold Yosef and what happened with the money and what was the role of the Ishmaelim and the Midianim and the Midianim. That was last week's class. Now we're going to try and look at the roles of the particular brothers who do speak up in the story. And last week we highlighted the difference between Reuven and Yehuda in chapter 37. And it's these two brothers that will follow their career and their speaking in the coming chapters. Pasuk Yutet. Vayomru ish al achiv, hine bala chalomot halazeba. As they're plotting from afar to kill Yosef, one brother says to the other, here comes the dreamer. And therefore, what should we do? Pasuk Chaf, let us go and kill him and throw him in one of the pits, and we'll say a wild animal ate him, and let's see what's going to be with all of his great dreams. Ha ha ha. Comes Reuven, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Vayishma Reuven, Vayatilehu Miyadam, Vayomer Lona Kenu Nafesh. Reuven gives what we described last week as the humanist argument. Murder is not good. Let's not be associated with murder. Let's not kill a soul. And then he has another suggestion in the subsequent verse in Chafet. Vayomer Alehem Reuven, Al Tishpachu Dam. Let's not have blood on our hands. Let's not spill blood. So instead of active murder, what should we do? Let's throw him in a pit. Let him either die by himself, or as the Torah tells us at the end of that verse, that his real goal was Laman Hatzil Oto Miyadam LaShivo El Aviv, that Reuven's true intent was ultimately to take Yosef out of the pit and return him to his father. But we meet Reuven, who is the Bechor, so it's not, shouldn't be surprising that he's the one speaking up and trying to intervene and assert leadership, because in Sefer Bereshit up till now, the dynamic has been to choose between either to automatically grant the Bechor the rights of the best inheritance and of continuing the father's mission, or that the Bechor is rejected and another son replaces the Bechor. So here we meet Reuven, the Bechor of all of Yaakov's children, the Bechor of Leah, but the eldest of all 12 of the tribes, trying to assert himself. But Reuven's assertion of leadership here is misplaced. He argues on simply humanistic grounds. It's not good to be involved in active murder, so therefore let's do something very passive. And he himself is hoping in the back of his mind that he'll come and take Yosef out of the pit and save him, so that ultimately even passive murder won't have to be on their record. And then we're told that as Yosef approaches his brothers, they seem to accept they accept Reuven's advice, they strip him of his robe, and they take him and they throw him into the pit. And the brothers, we assume, all imagine that what's going to happen to Yosef in the pit? What do the brothers think is going to happen? What's their goal in throwing Yosef into the pit? You can chat or speak up if you have a mic.
He will die.
Right. They're hoping to die. They're hoping to go back to plan A, right? Which was their plan of Vayitnaklu Otola Hamito. They were already plotting how to kill him. We know from the way the Torah tells us the story that Reuven, when he gave the pit advice, he had in mind that he wouldn't last long enough in the pit to die, but that ultimately Reuven would come to save him. And as the brothers are eating lunch, right, they see the different groups of merchants passing on this north-south trade route that we spoke about last week, and we spoke a little bit about these different groups that are coming. And in the middle of lunch, Yehuda speaks up, Pasuk Chaf Vav. But Yosef is already in the pit, and we were told that the pit is empty and has no water. In other words, there are no conditions there for him to be able to last for very long. Pasuk Chaf Vav. Vayomer Yehuda El Achav. What can we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? So instead of letting him die passively in this pit, but again, Yehuda recognizes that the brothers would be at fault because they threw him into the pit. So instead, Yehuda suggests, let's sell him to this group that's coming by, this caravan of merchants that's coming, v'yadeinu al tihibo, and let's not have our hand involved in any of this, let's not have our fingerprints on this, ki achinu v'sareinuhu, because he is our brother, our flesh, and his brothers were told, listen to him. How would you characterize the difference between Yehuda's argument to save Yosef and Reuven's argument to save Yosef?
Well, as you pointed out, Reuven is humanist, Yehuda's is strictly pragmatic.
Pragmatic, but also what words does he use? Let's look at the specific language, how each of them speaks about Yosef. Look how Reuven speaks. We're told, right, that he wants the Vayatzilehu miyadam, he saves him in Pasuk Chafalis from their hands. It doesn't say Vayatzil et Yosef miyadam. Yosef here is not an entity that he's encountering. He's saving a human being, Vayatzilehu. Right? And then he speaks about not killing nafesh, any living soul, and al tishpachu dam, let's not be involved in spilling blood. Hashlichu oto elabor, throw him into a pit. V'yad al tishlichu bo, and don't lay your hand on him. It's all very anonymous. It's about some anonymous entity, not my brother, not Yosef, he doesn't name him, he never calls him our brother. It's this anonymous humanistic argument. And Yehuda, in contrast, well, he is pragmatic, has a different perspective. Again, Yehuda here is clearly misplaced because, right, the best brother does not sell another brother into slavery, right, or sell him to another group in order to gain. Right, so he opens up by saying, ma betza, what are we going to gain? Let's make some money off of this. Let's at least make a deal. Just letting him die in the pit, we're not going to get anything out of it. So we wanted to do away with him. So at least let's make a profit. But the language that he uses is slightly more, call it, brotherly than Reuven's. Again, we're dealing here with warped brotherliness because obviously true brothers don't sell one another to a caravan of passing Yishmaelim. But at least he speaks about what will we gain ki naharog et achinu. He associates this brotherly connection with the boy in the pit and will cover his blood. And therefore, again, he says, let's sell him to the Yishmaelim and not have our hand be against him. Ki achinu v'sareinuhu, right? He's more than just a human being that we're not supposed to murder any humans, but he's actually our flesh and blood. So Yehuda and Reuven both offer arguments in chapter 37 for saving Yosef from death. Reuven's seems to be entirely misplaced. Number one, he doesn't tell the brothers his true intention of ultimately trying to save Yosef. So therefore, the brothers are convinced that Yosef's in the pit in order to die, like they had originally intended. Reuven has hopes that he'll come and he'll be able to get Yosef out in time. But Reuven's whole argument is this humanistic argument, let's not murder, it's not a good thing, we don't want to have blood on our hands, murder is not good. And he speaks about him in the third person. Comes Yehuda, who's one step better, but not a whole lot better. They're in the middle of lunch as Yosef is in this empty, dry pit. And Yehuda says to his brothers, at least let's make a profit out of all of this, and let's not be involved in having him die even passive death, because Achinu b'sarenu hu, he still is our flesh and blood. Yehuda understands the connection that there is still something brotherly. But I will suggest, and this is what we'll be tracing today, that in chapter 37, both Yehuda and Reuven have very, very misplaced attempts at leadership. Now, why is Yehuda stepping into the leadership for here? Why is he, of all the brothers, the next one to speak up? Reuven, we said, fits in some of the Sefer Bereishit model because he is the Bechor. He's the Bechor Le'ah. But Reuven, as we've read earlier in Sefer Bereishit, has already done some things that may have ousted him from being the actual Bechor. Where did we encounter Reuven previously? There are two incidents that I'm thinking of. Sorry about my headset today. There are two incidents that I'm thinking of about Reuven in Sefer Bereishit previously, where he may have, because of those incidents, messed his chances up of being the Bechor. Can anyone think of them? Both incidents have to do with him meddling a little bit too much in his father's relationship with his different wives.
Well, there's the incident with the Dudaim. There's the Dudaim.
Uh-huh.
And there's also...
Explain for a second what happened there.
Well, he didn't really do anything objectionable. He brought something to his mother. If they were a fertility symbol, then, you know, maybe you could say he was mixing in where he didn't belong, but it seems to be a conflict between the wives, and Reuven is just a bit player.
Right, but the rabbis certainly take it that if these Dudaim have some fertility, they're more than a symbol, they may even be some kind of potion. Right, that he was clearly meddling where he didn't belong.
But Reuven could hardly have been expected.
Where we meet Reuven.
Reuven could hardly have been expected to bring the Dudaim to one of the other wives. Certainly, he would bring it to his own mother.
100%. But still, he's involved in right. He's getting involved in his father's relationship with his wives, where he doesn't belong. As the eldest child, it's his job to stay out of that aspect of the family dynamics. The second incident where we meet Reuven meddling in his father's relationship with his wives is what incident?
When he moves the bed. When he moves the bed. Is that before this?
No, it's before our story here. It's before our story here. And in the Divrei Hayamim retelling of that story of the switching of the beds, it says very, very clearly that the Bechorah was taken away from Reuven because of that and given to Yehuda. So Reuven here in chapter 37 still wants to assume the mantle of leadership and of being the Bechor, but he has a very, very misplaced perspective on what brothers are about and what family responsibility is about. For him, it's all about humanistic values, about not murdering, but he doesn't get the word brother across his lips. And still, his suggestion is entirely warped. It leads all the other brothers to think that Yosef is going to languish in the pit and ultimately die. Who are the next candidates that could have been up for Bechorah? If Reuven is going to be deposed, right, and demoted, who could take over? Next comes Shimon and Levi. But in chapter 34, we already encountered Shimon and Levi engaged in something that offended Yaakov tremendously, which we could assume probably knock them off the list of potential heirs and leaders of the Shvatim. That's the story of Dinah, when they go and they massacre the city of Shechem. Yaakov ends the story by rebuking them and saying, why did you make my relationship now with all my neighbors stink. Why did you do this? You changed the tenor of our whole dynamic here in the land. How did you do this to us? That's Shimon and Levi. Next in line comes Yehuda. So it's not a, I don't think it's a coincidence that the candidate we meet speaking up in Perek Lamed Zayin, besides Reuven, is Yehuda. Yehuda is now trying to assert himself as leader. Reuven has erred. Shimon and Levi were told off by their father in chapter 37. And now Yehuda is trying to speak up. And Yehuda, as we saw in chapter 37, does a little bit better than Reuven, but still, he's quite misplaced. What we'll be doing now is a sketch of what happens between Reuven, Yehuda, and ultimately Yosef in the coming chapters. We'll be seeing how their arguments change and how one of them rises to leadership. And then we'll go back and we'll ask the question, what happened after the story of Mechirat Yosef between the arguments that we're about to look at that changed the picture and that taught the lesson of what leadership and true family responsibility is all about. So I apologize, but we're going to be dealing with relatively large quantities of text. So let's move ahead now. We're skipping chapter 38 for a few minutes. We'll get back to that later. And we're going to look at chapter 42, Perek Membet. This is the dramatic story of Yosef's revelation to his brothers. Let's just set the background here. Right, Perek Membet, chapter 42, opens when Yaakov, the brothers have returned one time. And the brothers haven't gone down yet. Yaakov sees that hears that there is food in Egypt, and he sees that the famine is getting worse and worse. And he sends the sons down, 10 of them, to go buy food, and he keeps Binyamin at home, of course, because he's afraid of Yosef's story, take 2. And Yosef sees his brothers, and we're told in verse 7 of chapter 42, Vayakirem, he recognizes them immediately. He has no doubt about whom they are. Vayitznaker alehem, however, he acts to them like a stranger. In other words, he doesn't reveal himself right away. Vayidaber itam kashot, and he immediately begins tough questioning of them. Where are you from? And what are you doing here? And how is your family? And what's going on in your family? And the brothers answer, and they say a little bit too much, which ultimately comes back to haunt them. And Yosef accuses them of being spies, and he tells them, well, the only way you'll get out of this is if you bring that younger brother that you mentioned here. Then you'll show me that you're truly not spies. And Yosef then charges them in Pasuk Yud Tet that in the meantime, well, they go back to Eretz Canaan to bring Binyamin, the youngest brother that they mentioned. They should leave one brother locked up in jail as their collateral. And bring Binyamin, and then you won't die, and I'll sell you the grain. Let's look at Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Vayomru ish el achiv. The brothers say one to another, Aval ha-shemim anachnu al achinu asher ra'inu tzarat nafsho b'itchananu eleinu v'lo shamanu. Al-kein ba'a eleinu ha-tzara hazot. The brothers right away assume guilt. They right away plead guilty among themselves, and they say, wow, how did we get into this horrible situation? We just came to buy grain, and suddenly now here we are in Egypt. We've got this antagonistic leader. He's taking one brother to jail. He's asking us to come back with a different brother. We are in trouble. How did we get here? Because of our alachinu. Because remember, we had that other brother. We had that brother Yosef that we saw him suffering when he was begging to us, something that in chapter 37 the Torah didn't tell us in the direct narrative, but now we hear it in their retelling of what happened. And they confess. They say, look, you know, we did the wrong thing. He was crying out for help from the pit, and we didn't answer. Therefore, we're now in trouble. That's what one brother says to another. Pasuk Chatbet, Vayan Reuven Otam. Reuven, again, trying to be the Bechor, trying to pull the family together in this moment of crisis, turns to these brothers who are just confessing, and he says to them, Halo amarti elechem lemor al techetu uvayeled v'lo shema'atem. And didn't I tell you not to sin regarding that boy, and you didn't listen? V'gam damo hine nidrash. And you're right, now his blood is being demanded of us. What's Reuven's argument called in very simple terms? I told you so. Right? Ruvain is saying, you're absolutely right that we're guilty and we're suffering now for what we did to Yosef. But it wasn't my idea. I had a better plan. I told you that we weren't supposed to murder him, and nobody listened to me. Therefore, we're now in trouble. How do you assess Ruvain's assertion of leadership here? Is this effective? Is this a good argument to 9 other brothers in a moment of crisis like this? No, he's whining. He's saying, I told you so. He's being self-righteous, right? And remember that what was his original argument? His original argument was, let's throw him in a pit and not be involved in active murder. Let's just have him passively die. And then he said to himself, and I'll get him out and save him. And of course, we read in chapter 37, but that by the time he got there, Yosef was long gone. So Ruvain here tries a second time to assert himself, and he does a pretty poor job of that. He doesn't have what we would call the makeup of a true leader, and certainly he has no sense of true family responsibility. Family responsibility is what the rest of the brothers said. We're in trouble because of something terrible that we did to our brother. And comes to Ruvain and says, well, I told you so. It wasn't my idea. You just didn't listen to me. If we progress in the story, right, Yosef continues to listen to them. He sends them home with some grain so that they can have something to eat along the way and give to their families back there. And, of course, that's the famous story of Yosef returning their money in their bags. And they get to the Malon, to the respite at night, and they open their bags and they find the money. And, of course, they're all distraught. And they realize what they did wrong. And they come home and they tell Yaakov the whole story. I'm sorry, they find the money when they get to Yaakov, right? And Yaakov, they tell Yaakov the whole story of their interrogation by this tough king. And they're opening their bags and they find the money in their bags. And they and their father are very afraid. Let's look at Pasuk Lamed Vav. We're going to look at two more verses from this chapter. 36. Vayomer Alehem Yaakov Avihem. As they're opening their bags and the money is there, Yaakov says to them, Oti Shikaltem. You've already made me childless. Yosef einenu, v'shimon einenu, v'binyamin tikachu, alai hayu chulana. Yaakov can't believe what they're telling him. Yosef's been long gone, he says to them, now Shimon's gone, and what, now you're asking to take Binyamin? Are you crazy? I'm not going to be able to live like this. Vayomer Reuven el aviv. Here comes our Bechor again, trying to step into the mantle of leadership. And now again, his father realizes that the situation is getting worse. The father thought that just one son was gone, Yosef, years ago, and now Shimon is stuck in Egypt, in jail, and now the brothers are asking to take Binyamin too, and Yaakov says, Ad kan, I can't lose all my children. You've already made me childless once, and now a second time. You're not going to do it a third time. Comes Reuven and steps in to try and save the day. Vayomer Reuven el aviv lemor, et shnei vanai tamit im lo avienu elecha. Says, no problem, Dad. You can kill my two sons if I don't bring him back to you, Binyamin. T'nau to'al yadi, v'ani ashivenu elecha. I'm telling you, you give me Binyamin, I'll be responsible for him. I'll bring him back to you. And of course, if I don't, you can kill my two sons. Answers Yaakov in Pasuk Lamed Chet, v'yomer lo yered b'ni imachem. No way. My son Binyamin, he's not going with you back to Egypt. Ki achiv his mate, because his brother died already. The hula vadon ishar, he's the only one left from his mother. Ukra'ahu ason vaderech asher tachuba, zehoravetem et tzivati biyagon sh'ola. And says Yaakov, if something bad happens to Binyamin along the way, you're just going to bring me to my early death. What's Reuven's argument here? What's wrong with it? And how does Yaakov respond to him? Maybe Reuven's argument to Yaakov, trying to save the day and get Yaakov to agree to send Binyamin down so that they can get Shimon out of jail and come back with more grain. Reuven's argument is, I'll take the boy, I'll be responsible, I'll return him to you, and if I don't bring him back, if I don't bring back Binyamin, then you can kill my two sons. That obviously did not sit very well with Yaakov. Right, again, here we meet Reuven with a very, very misplaced sense of family responsibility. He thinks that part of taking responsibility is saying, if I don't bring you back Binyamin, then kill my two sons. Obviously, Yaakov is not going to kill his two grandsons because another son doesn't return home. Obviously, the offer to kill two grandsons was not something that would convince Yaakov to send Binyamin down to Egypt. So here we have another attempt of Reuven to step into the fore and to try and save the day in the moment of crisis. And again, he's misplaced. We met him first in chapter 37, Al Tishpachu Dam, let's not murder, let's do something passive. Then we met him earlier in chapter 42, trying to argue with the brothers when they say, Aval Hashemim Anachnu Al Achino, and he says, well, I told you so. You didn't listen to me. Chaval that you didn't pay attention to me. I gave better advice at the time. And now, when Yaakov is distraught over the notion of sending Binyamin down, Reuven comes up with what he thinks is a great idea. No problem, he says, if I don't bring him back to you, you can kill my two sons. To which Yaakov says, what, you want to kill me and send me to my early death? That is not an option. And it's at this point that the character that we're going to meet exclusively trying to step forward and argue both to Yaakov and ultimately to Yosef is no longer Reuven. Reuven's attempts at asserting responsibility and leadership of the brothers and of the family unit have failed. Now, the character we're going to follow is that of Yehuda. Chapter 43 opens that the famine is getting worse in the land and they've finished all the food that they brought back from Egypt. And now they realize that it's time to go back and try and get Shimon out and get more food and go down to Egypt. But, of course, they need to bring Binyamin. So let's look at Yehuda's argument trying to convince Yaakov to send Binyamin. And we'll see that it's very different than what Reuven argued, namely, if I don't bring him back, you can kill my two sons. Chapter 43, Perek Mem Gimel, starting in Pasuk Gimel, after they realize that they need to go back and get more food. Vayomer elav Yehuda lemor, ha'ed ha'id banu ha'ish lemor, lo tiru fanai bilti achichem itchem. Yehuda says to his father Yaakov, look, there's no point in us going down to Egypt unless we bring Binyamin, because the man in Egypt, that mean king, he specifically told us, don't come back without that brother. It says, Yehuda, im yeshcha mishalech et achinu itanu, nerda v'nishbera lecha ochel. If, he says to his father, it's very, very simple, Dad. If you send the boy with us, our brother with us, and again, it's our brother, Binyamin is our brother. If you send our brother with us, then we can go down and get you food, purchase you food. V'im encha mishalech, but if you don't send him, Dad, lo nered, we're not going to go down to Egypt. Because the man told us, he says to his father, don't come without your brother. Vayomer Yisrael, lama hareotim li lahagid laisha od lachem ach. Of course, Yaakov rebukes the brothers. Why on earth did you tell them in the first place that you have another brother? And they say, well, he asked us. He asked us all about you. Is your father alive? Do you have any more brothers? And we told him everything. Did we know that he was going to say, bring down your brother? Yaakov is distraught. He doesn't quite know what to do. The family is at risk of dying from famine. And he has to decide which is the worst risk, continuing to wait for food and rain in Eretz Canaan, or to risk sending Binyamin and potentially losing Binyamin. And of course, Yaakov has no idea what's really happened to Shimon. Shimon's locked in jail in Egypt. Yaakov has no communication, doesn't know what's going on. And all he can think of is, this is going to be the third story of Yosef. Pasukhet. Vayomer Yehuda el Aviv. El Yisrael Aviv. Yehuda steps up to the fore. At this point, Reuven is out of the picture. Reuven has not succeeded in any of his previous attempts to assert himself as a true leader and take family responsibility. Now comes Yehuda. And he says to his father, Shilcha hana'ar iti. First of all, send the boy with me. Vinakuma v'nelecha. And let us start going. V'nichyav v'lonamut. If you don't send him with us and we stay here, we'll die. So at least send him with us and we have a chance to live and not die. Gam anachnu, gam ata, v'gam tatenu. All of us, our whole extended family, will have a chance to live. Anochi e'ervenu. Yehuda says to his father, I will take responsibility, from the language of eravon, a collateral. Miyadi tivakshenu. You'll seek him out from my hand. Im lo havi'otiv elecha, if I don't bring him to you, v'hitzagtiv lefanecha, and I don't present him before you when we return safely, v'chatati lecha kol hayamim, I'll be one who has sinned to you forever. Kilulei hitma'amanu, and Yehuda says to his father very practically looked at, if we wouldn't have waited all this time, while you were thinking about what to do with Binyamin, ki atav shavnu zepamayim, we could have already returned twice. In other words, let's not waste any more time. We're all at risk of dying. Send Binyamin with me, and I promise to take responsibility for him. And he uses two expressions, Anochi e'ervenu, I will take collateral for him. I will be his collateral. I will be responsible. Miyadi tevakshenu, you can seek him out from my hand. And if I don't bring him back to you, he says, then I will have sinned all my days to you. And Yaakov realizes that he doesn't have much of a choice. He's persuaded that Yehuda will truly take responsibility for Binyamin, and he tells them to go and to take gifts and to try and buy the food and come back as safely as possible with Shimon and with Binyamin. So a clear difference here in chapter 43 between the arguments of Yehuda trying to get Binyamin to go with him and what we met in the previous chapter, 42, of Reuven's argument for Yaakov to send Binyamin. Reuven said, if I don't bring him back, you can kill my two sons. Yehuda understands by this point something much greater about family and brotherly responsibility. And he says to his father, I will be responsible. You can seek him from my hand. And if I don't return him to you, v'chatati l'cha kol hayamim, then I will be sinning, I will live in sin towards you for the rest of my days. A very different perspective on what it means to take responsibility. Now what will be, we'll look at two more sets of psukim in the next chapter, and then we'll be talking about, well, what changed with Yehuda? When we met him in 37, in the story of Mechirat Yosef, he wasn't so great at taking family responsibility. He was albeit better than Reuven. He didn't speak only on these humanistic terms about not murdering. He did in 37 talk about a brother and Achinu Besarenu, who are flesh and blood, and therefore we shouldn't kill him. However, Yehuda in chapter 37 could still allow for the possibility of selling a brother to the Yishmaelim, which is obviously not all that brotherly and not all that responsible. So before we talk about what changed, let's just look at one more set of psukim. Last set of psukim for this sketch, chapter 44, Perek Mem Zalad. Right, the story progresses that the brothers go down to Egypt and they present the present to Yosef and they show Yosef Binyamin, and of course Yosef is overcome with mercy, and he runs out of the room, and he cries, and he feeds the brothers, and then he has his first encounter with Binyamin, and he sets the table with all the brothers according to their age, and they're astonished that he knows the order. And then he sends the brothers home with the grain, and of course this is the famous story. I'm sorry, this is when the brothers come and they say to Yosef while they're sitting at the table that he just set up, they say, listen, we had this problem last time, the money was returned in our bags. And then he sends them, and now they go to the Malon to sleep, and they find the gavia in the bag of Binyamin. And they realize that this time they're really in for it. Let's look at Perek Mem Dalet, chapter 44. Verse 13. When they find the gavia, the goblet, in Binyamin's sack, they tear their clothes as a sign of mourning, and they right away make a U-turn and return back to the city. Pasuk Yudalit. Vayavo Yehuda ve'echav Beta Yosef. They used to be called Achei Yosef, Vayavo ha'achim. Now they are Yehuda ve'echav. Yehuda is clearly the leader of the pack. It's Yehuda and his brothers. And they come to the house of Yosef, and he's still there, and they bow down before him. And Yosef says, what's this terrible thing that you did to take my goblet? And Yehuda, in Pasuk Tet Zayin, in verse 16, tries to defend the brothers. He says, Vayomer Yehuda, Mano ma'ala adoni ma'nedaber u'manit tadak. He says, sir, we don't have any argument. We can't justify ourselves. What can we say to you? Elohim atzayet avon avadecha. God has found the sin of your servant. In other words, what are we supposed to say to you? The only way we can explain this terrible tragedy that the gavia ended up in our bags is that God is punishing us. And he offers, hinenu avadim la'adoni. The only thing he says I can offer you is take us all as slaves for yourself. Gam anachnu, gam asher nimta gavia biado. Take the whole group of us as slaves, all of us, including the one whom the gavia was found in his bag. And of course Yosef says, God forbid, I'm not going to do that. I'll only take the one who the gavia was in his bag. And then, Pasuk Yudchet, the beginning of Parshat Vayigash, Yehuda doesn't agree to let one brother again go and disappear. He's not willing to let go of Binyamin so quickly here. Vayigash elav Yehuda vayomer. Bi Adoni, Yehuda says, wait a minute, listen up, sir, he says. Please, let me speak to you. Please don't get angry because I know you're on Paro's level. And then Yehuda begins an argument with Yosef. And he begins to explain, it's a legal argument, it's not a picking a fight, it's an explanation. He tries to defend the brothers, and he says, you started off and you asked us, this is verse 19, you asked us, do we have a father, do we have a brother, and we told you the truth. Remember, you were accusing us of being spies, and we told you the truth, that we have an old father and a young brother at home, and that one other brother died, and that the father really loves the young brother still at home. And you said, please bring him down here. And we told you we won't be able to because our father won't want to part with him, and if he does, it will cause our father grief and he'll ultimately die. And you said, well, if you don't bring your brother down, I won't sell you any more grain, don't come back here. And when we went back up to our father, we told him everything you said, and our father said, go get more food. And we said, we can't get more food because the man told us not to come unless we have our younger brother. And our father said, well, you know, I had two beloved children from my special wife, and one of them has already been killed, and I haven't seen him. And if you take the second one from me, Binyamin, and something bad happens to him, I'll go early to the grave, and I'll die. And now, Pasuk Lamed, Yehuda says to Yosef, whom he doesn't know that's Yosef, he says to the viceroy of Egypt, Ve'ata, and now, Kivoi Elavdecha Avi, if I leave Binyamin here with you as you've requested, and if I come back to my father, v'hanar einenu itanu, and the boy is not going to be with us, v'nafsho k'shura v'nafsho, their souls are intertwined. What's going to be? V'hayakir oto ki ein hanar v'amet, when my father will see that the boy is not with us, he'll drop dead. V'horidu avadecha et sevat avdecha avinu biagon sha'ola, and then all of us brothers will be guilty of bringing our father early to the grave. Ki abdecha arav et hanar ne'im avi lemor. He says to Yosef, to the king, and to Yosef, he says, because I have taken personal responsibility for this boy from my father, and I said to him, quote, im lo avienu elecha, if I don't return him to you, v'chatati la'avi kol hayamin, then I'll forever be guilty to you, I'll forever be in sin to you. He says, take me as the slave instead of Binyamin in whom Sack the Gavia was found. And let the boy at least go back with his brothers. How can I, Yehuda, go back to my father without the boy? Pen erev ara asher yimtza et avi, lest I see the bad that will befall my father, a premature, grieving death. How do you distinguish between what is special about Yehuda's argument here to Yosef? What things does he point to that ultimately lead Yosef in the next verse, at the beginning of chapter 45, to immediately reveal himself to his brothers? What does Yehuda say here that makes Yosef reveal his identity and not take Binyamin as a slave and not even take Yehuda as a slave but immediately confess, Ani Yosef? You want to send it by chat, please? First of all, Yehuda's argument is very different than when we met Reuven, also in Yosef's house, speaking to the brothers after they admitted their guilt. And he shows his love and respect of his father, very good. And he emphasizes not only his love and respect of his father, how he wouldn't want to bring his father to a premature death, but he emphasizes the responsibility that he took in order to bring Binyamin down to Egypt, and how strongly he feels that Binyamin must return safely to his father, even if it means that Yehuda has to be a slave now to the king of Egypt. And Yehuda highlights for Yosef that he has taken personal responsibility for another brother in order not to cause grief and pain to their father, who's already suffered such grief and pain by the loss of the first brother, whom the father thinks is dead. And it's this argument that makes Yosef immediately reveal himself to the brothers and tell them who he is. And it seems that Yosef, right, is moved by the fact that the brothers whom he encountered in chapter 37, without a lot of brotherly love, who had hated him repeatedly, who added jealousy, who couldn't speak peacefully, who plotted to kill him before he even got close, who stripped him and threw him into a pit, who didn't respond when he cried out to him, who sold him to the Yishma'elim. Now, these same brothers, led by Yehuda, and again, the group was identified as Yehuda ve'Echav, who come to Beit Yosef. These same brothers, led by Yehuda, now look at brothers and brotherly responsibility very, very, very differently than they did in chapter 37. These brothers, led by Yehuda, now make an argument for not causing their father additional grief, and Yehuda stands up and says, I took responsibility for him. Of course I have to make sure he gets back safely. Brother takes responsibility for another brother. Of course I can't let him stay here as a slave. Take me as a slave, if need be, and let the boy go back safely to his father. And it seems that this argument of brotherly responsibility and caring for the father by not wanting the father to see any more grief and any more tragedies happen to between the brothers, this seems to be the argument that moves Yosef. But the question I want to pose is, what changed with Yehuda? This Yehuda in chapter 44 is not the same Yehuda who makes the argument in chapter 37 of Ma betza ki naharog et achinu. What monetary gain will there be if we sell our, if we kill our brother? Excuse me. Therefore, let's sell him, at least make a profit. And again, he won't die immediately, because hopefully he'll live as a slave. But better for us to make some money than for the boy to die in a pit. Right? Because again, ki achinu b'sareinu, he's our flesh and our brother. It wouldn't be good for us to watch him die here directly. How do we get from that argument to the argument that Yehuda made before Yaakov, Anochi Ervenu, I take responsibility for him, if I don't bring him back then v'chatati l'cha kol hayamim, I'll be in sin to you for. And ultimately, Yehuda repeating that argument to Yosef and saying, the boy can't stay here as a slave. If you need to keep a slave, then keep me, but let this boy go home because his father will die a premature grieving death if he doesn't return, and I took responsibility. I promised my father that the boy would come back safely. How do we get from 37 Yehuda to 44 Yehuda? He matured, he grew up, good, but what I want to focus on is that there's a story in the Torah that tells the maturity and the maturation process of Yehuda, and that is chapter 38. Which we will look at now for the remainder of the shiur, and we will see that chapter 38 interrupts the Yosef narrative. And chapter 38 tells the story of Yehuda's learning to take family responsibility. He himself lost two sons, very good, so he has a sense of what that means, very, very good, and we're going to see some other details in the story that teach Yehuda what it means to take true responsibility, personal and family responsibility. Let's just look for a minute at the last verse of chapter 37 of Lamed Zayin. Perak Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Lamed Vav. V'hamidanim achru oto el Mitzrayim, l'potifar sris paro sara tabachim. That's the closing verse of the story of Mechirat Yosef, telling us how Yosef got down to Mitzrayim, and he was ultimately ending up there in the house of Potiphar. If you look at the first verse of chapter 39, Lamed Tet, this is the automatic continuation of where chapter 37 ends. V'Yosef hurad Mitzrayim, and Yosef was brought down to Egypt. V'iknehu Potiphar sris paro sara tabachim ish mitzri. Potiphar bought him from miyad ha'yishme'elim asher horiduhu shana, from the hands of the Yishme'elim who brought him down. 37 ends where 39 picks up. They both end with Yosef coming down to Egypt, ending up in Potiphar's household, who buys him from the caravans that brought him down from Canaan. Interrupting this, what would be a beautiful narrative flow, comes chapter 38, smack in the middle of the Yosef narrative. Chapter 38 is the famous story of Yehuda and Tamar, and as we'll try and highlight in the next few minutes, it's a story of Yehuda learning to take responsibility and maturing And this is how Yehuda becomes somebody very, very different between 37 and the subsequent times where we meet him taking responsibility for Binyamin towards Yaakov and presenting that argument before Yosef. So let's look at a few elements in chapter 38. And this reading of chapter 38 I heard many, many years ago from Professor Zakovich, a professor of Bible at the Hebrew University. And I think it has many, many elements that contribute to our whole understanding of this closing section of Sefer Breshit. It opens with Vayhi ba'et ha'hi. It is at this time, at the same time as Mechirat Yosef, Vayered Yehuda me'et achav. And that verb Vayered, that Yehuda descended from his brothers, is the subject of much discussion in the Midrash. The Midrash has probably 8 to 10 different interpretations of what the descent of Yehuda is. We won't get into it today, but that verb of descent clearly connotes something negative that's happening here. Yehuda does something, he goes down, he descends, he goes lower than his brothers. So while we just ended chapter 37 with a terrible story between brothers, brothers being able to allow one of them to be sold into slavery, instead of sticking together and going to their father and either fessing up, admitting, or at least helping their father with his grief, what happens after Yaakov reacts to Yosef's death or perceived death? Yehuda splits from his brother. He leaves his brothers. Vayet ad isha dulami ushmo chira. And he goes not even to a cousin, not even to somebody within the family. He goes to a person in the region of Adulam whose name is Chira. Vayarsham Yehuda bat ish Kna'ani ushmo Shua. He sees the daughter of a Canaanite man, and Canaanite Kna'ani people in Sefer Breshit are not the beloved people. They are Arur Kena'an. They are the cursed seed, and the seed that Abraham makes very clear to his Eved that he has no interest in Yitzchak marrying one of the Canaanite women. Therefore, he sends them all the way back to find a wife from Aram Naharaim. So whom does Yehuda take as a wife right away when he splits from his brothers after Mechirat Yosef and after seeing Yaakov's grief? He goes and he takes the daughter of a Canaanite man. He takes her, and he has relations with her, and she conceives, and she has the first son, Er, and the second son, Onan, and the third son, Shelah. And if we look at Pesukim, Gimel, Dalet, and Hey, where the children are born, we'll notice, if we read carefully, that there's a difference in Yehuda's role in each of the children's birth. Pesuk Gimel, Vatahar Vatelet Bein, Vayikra et Shmo Er. At the birth of the first child, Yehuda is present. He names the child. Vayikra. Yehuda names the child Er. Second child. Vatahar od Vatelet Bein. She conceives and has a child. Vatikra et Shmo Onan. She, the woman, calls, right, Shua, right, Batshua, calls the second son a name. She calls him Onan. Vatosef od Vatelet Bein. Vatikra et Shmo Shelah. The third birth, she also names the child. V'haya b'chziv b'lidata oto. Yehuda wasn't even present at the time of the third birth. He was in a place called Kziv. And if you look at the names of the children, especially that third child, Shelah and Kziv, Shelah, the name of the child, and Kziv, the place where Yehuda is when the child is born, both of them are expressions of deception in Tanakh. The verb lahashlot and the verb lachziv both mean to deceive, to trick. So interestingly enough, there are three children born, and Yehuda's involvement in their birth and in their naming grows increasingly distant. At the first birth, he names the child. At the second birth, she names the child, but we hear from the Torah the assumption that he was there. The third birth, she names the child, and he's not even there when the child is born. And the child she names Deception, and Yehuda is in a place called Deception when she gives birth. And then we have the tragic story that he marries off Er, and Er commits sins, and God punishes him, and Yehuda turns to Onan, the second son, and he offers him the option of Yibum for his sister-in-law, and Onan doesn't like the idea of Yibum, and therefore he does not want to have full relations with her, and he commits what's called onanism, and God doesn't like that, and God kills the second son, Onan. And then Yehuda tricks Tamar, and he tells her to please stay at home and wait his daughter-in-law, Tamar, the wife of the first son, who was hoping for the second son to take her. The second son didn't want that. And now he tells her to wait with her at her father's house until Shelah, the third son, grows up. And she waits a long time, and Yehuda's wife dies, the Canaanite wife that he takes dies, and in Pasuk Yudet we're told that she dies, and Yehuda, Vayinachem Yehuda, Yehuda is very quickly comforted, and he goes off to the sheep shearing festival with his friend Chira, that we met at the beginning of the chapter. And then we have the famous story of how he meets Tamar along the way, and he thinks she's a prostitute, she's dressed up as a prostitute, and he pays her, he takes her, and of course she asks him to leave some important identification, right? And he leaves his chotemet and his petulim, his seal, which is basically like his credit card, and his petulim, his cloak, and he leaves them with her. And then when he goes back to collect his things, we're told, right, she's not there, and the famous story that he gets upset that she's not there. And he doesn't even go directly in Pasuk Chaf to go find, to go collect his things, to meet the prostitute herself and collect his identity cards and his telephone, his credit card and his cell phone. But he sends his friend Chira Hadulami to go get them. And she's not there at the time. And when the people say, we haven't seen a prostitute here, Yehuda in verse 23 says to his friend, right, Tikachla, we better go find her, right? Take them to her. Penny hielavuz, lest you and me end up being scorned. He throws his friend into the whole picture of being scorned for going to a prostitute. He says, we have to go find her. And then, of course, the story ends that he finds out a few months later that his daughter-in-law, Tamar, who was supposed to be waiting for the third son to be old enough, that she's pregnant, and that obviously she became pregnant out of marriage. And right away, he tells her verdict, Hotziu havetus tisareh, take her out and have her burned. She belongs to be burned at the stake for being a prostitute. And as she's being led out to death, she right away shows Yehuda's identity things, his chotemet and hapsilim, and she says, whoever these are, this is the man that I became pregnant from. And we're told at the end of the story, by Yaker Yehuda, verse 26, he recognizes all of this, and he says, Sadkami meni, she's more right than I am. She's right. Because I didn't give her Shelah. And then we're told he didn't continue to interact with Tamar anymore. And that she gives birth and the twins become, she gives birth to twins and that they ultimately become the heirs of Malchut Beit David. Professor Zakovich suggests that if we do this careful reading of this story, we'll see that Yehuda learns the lesson of family responsibility here. The story of chapter 38 opens with Yehuda running away from responsibility. He and the rest of his brothers just sold Yosef into slavery, but at his suggestion, they caused their father tremendous grief when they brought back the blood-drenched Ketonet Pasim, trying to trick Yaakov to think that Yosef was killed. We'll be concluding in 2 minutes. And instead of staying with the family at this moment of crisis and trying to help Yaakov deal with his grief and help all the brothers deal with their guilt and help himself deal with his guilt for suggesting to sell Yosef into slavery. Chapter 38 opens with Yehuda descending, going down, sinning, and leaving his family. And where does he go? He goes to the exact opposite. He goes to an Ish Kna'ani and takes his Canaanite daughter, the group that has been forbidden in Sefer Bereishit for Zerah Abraham to interact with. Yehuda runs, takes a Canaanite wife, has these three children, is less and less involved in each of the births. By the third birth, he's not even there when she gives birth. He's in a place called Deception. And then we have the story of the widow, the wife waiting, Tamar waiting for the third son after the first husband dies and the second son refuses to do Yibum for her. And she's waiting, and Yehuda then loses his wife. He quickly gets over his grief. He goes to the sheep shearing festival, which was a big party in ancient times. He seems not to have much connection to family, whatever family he has left. He's lost two sons. He's got a third son left. His wife dies, and where is he? Right away, he gets over his grief and runs off to the sheep shearing festival. On the way, he meets a prostitute. He has no qualms about sleeping with her. She becomes pregnant, and when he learns that it's Tamar who's pregnant, he right away says, take her out and kill her. And along the way, before he learns she's pregnant, when he tries to go reclaim his chotemet and ptilim, he doesn't even go directly. He doesn't take personal responsibility for his act of going to a prostitute. But he sends his friend Chira again. And when Chira comes back and says she's not there, nobody knows where the prostitute is, he says, "Oy, pen hiel avuz, this is really not good. You and I are both going to end up looking scorned. This is going to end up being shameful for both of us. It's not good for both of us." What did Chira do? Chira didn't sleep with the prostitute, Yehuda did. But he doesn't take personal responsibility for his actions. And it's not until he hears that Tamar is pregnant and he declares, "Hotsiua v'tisareif, let her go be burnt at the stake for being a prostitute," that suddenly something changes. She stands up and she says, "Hey, Hakerna, whose are these? L'miya chotemet v'aptilim." And of course, the Midrash is sensitive that she borrows the same words that Yehuda and his brothers used when they showed the blood-soaked ketonet of Yosef to Yaakov in the previous chapter. They also said, "Hakerna, haktonet binchahi. Hakerna, hakerna. Is this the same one? Do you know who this is? Do you know whose it is?" And Yehuda, of course, immediately recognizes his chotemet and his ptilim, and here is where the change is. He says, "Tzadka mimeni, she's right, and I am wrong." And it's this change when Yehuda takes responsibility for his actions, and he says, "You know, Tamar is right. She's not guilty. She doesn't deserve to be burnt at the stake for being a prostitute, because I promised her that I'd bring her Shelah, and I never did. I never brought her my third son." Remember, the one whose name means deception. Right, and the one who's, he was in deception place when the third son was born. And I think what we can suggest is that it's chapter 38 that's the turning point as far as Yehuda taking responsibility. Chapter 37 introduced us to a Yehuda who's willing to let his brother be sold into slavery for financial gain, who calls him a brother. He wants to be brotherly and responsible and assert leadership, but he has a misplaced way of doing it. He sells his brother into slavery. And after Yaakov learns of this terrible tragedy that he receives the blood-drenched ketonet pasim of Yosef, Yaakov is in deep mourning, and what does Yehuda do? Chapter 38 opens, he leaves his brother, he skips town, and he goes to meet Canaanites, and he takes a Canaanite wife, and he has Canaanite children, all of that being very, very far from what Zerah Avraham is supposed to do. And as the story progresses, he's increasingly distant from the birth. He doesn't keep his promise of giving the third son. He goes after his own wife dies and immediately goes to a sheep-shearing festival, sleeps with a prostitute, and ultimately, right, is very quick to judge Tamar, but he himself has a very hard time taking responsibility for his actions until she shows him that it's really him, at which point he says, "Tzadka mimeni, she's right because I didn't bring her to Shelah." And it's by the end of chapter 38 that Yehuda has matured. And he ironically hasn't matured from within the context of his native family, in the family of Yaakov and the rest of the brothers. He matures by leaving, by doing something very wrong, going to a Canaanite family, taking a Canaanite woman, tricking his daughter-in-law, ultimately sleeping with her as a prostitute. And it's only at the end of chapter 38, when she proves him wrong, that he confesses and takes steps up and owns responsibility for his own actions. And it's from this point on that we see a different Yehuda. The Yehuda that we meet standing up to Yaakov, asking for Binyamin to go down to Egypt, and the Yehuda that we meet interacting with Yosef, trying to take responsibility for all of the brothers, this Yehuda is a very different responsibility. This is a very different Yehuda. This is the brotherly responsibility Yehuda, the Yehuda of Anochi e'ervenu. I'll take responsibility. Miyadi tevakshenu. You can seek him from my hands. And if I don't bring him back, he says to his father, I'll sin to you forever. This Yehuda has learned to take responsibility. So what we've tried to see today is the transformation of the attempts at leadership from chapter 37 through the rest of the narrative between Yosef and his brothers. And it's Reuven who has the misplaced values and the misplaced attempts at leadership who gets pushed aside in the search for leaders among Bnei Israel. And it's Yehuda who rises to the challenge. And he rises to the challenge and transforms himself from the one who was willing to sell Yosef into slavery in chapter 37 to one who can ultimately take responsibility for Binyamin coming down to Egypt and is willing to say to his father, I'll be the one responsible if he doesn't come back, tells Yosef that he's willing to personally go to jail and not Binyamin. And it's this Yehuda who leads the brothers and brings the brothers to salvation by being able to let them buy grain and return back to Yaakov. And it's ultimately this Yehuda and his form of taking responsibility and proving to Yosef that the brothers have changed and now know how to treat another brother, it's this Yehuda that leads Yosef to reveal himself to the rest of his brothers. So that's today's shiur. The sources in the rest of the source sheet, if you want to look at, should give you some interesting reading for Shabbat, some different theories about why Yosef did not reveal himself sooner, how come he didn't send the letter, famous Ramban, and then some critiques of the Ramban and some alternative perspectives on what Yosef was trying to achieve by not revealing himself sooner. I'm here for any questions, and thank you for joining. You're welcome. Thank you.